We're in the second week of a series called Believe. We believe it is time for us to take the next step as a church, to expand our mission and our capacity to reach people. Last week, what I did is I laid out for you three steps that we believe that we need to take immediately, including expanding capacity at our existing facilities, starting 2 to 3 new campuses in the next 24 months, and then getting to work on our more permanent facility. And what we are doing during this time is we are going to be asking our church family to sacrificially give to make this possible. On March 1st, there is going to be a special offering and a time of commitment. That is what's coming. You got an insert when you came in that will explain some of the details and hopefully address some of the questions that I know you have. What I am doing in these messages is trying to show you the what and the why of what we are doing. Now, if you were a guest, I want you to understand, okay, that this is not something that is directed at you. This, you know, I hope will, you know, be a time for you to get acquainted with the vision of our church, even though this is not directly for you, our guest. I still hope it's a time that you can kind of figure out what's going on here and what is important to us and what we are about. This is kind of like, you know, kitchen talk for the church family. It's really intimate and potentially awkward. I know it might make you a bit sheepish, you know, like you just stumbled into an argument, okay? That's kind of what you've done. You know, if you've ever been at somebody's house and they're around the kitchen table and they get in an argument and you're like, I'm here, I'm a guest, you know, I don't talk to each other. That's kind of how I know some of you may end up feeling on some of this stuff. And please, I just ask you for a little grace on this, but I hope you'll see who we are and what's important to us, okay? Luke chapter 15 is where we're going to be today. So if you have a Bible, open it to the third gospel, the gospel of Luke. And we're going to start in the 15th chapter and hopefully work our way all the way through. All right, Luke 15, hear it. I will also put it here on the screen. Luke 15 opens up with a brewing conflict between two very different groups of people. Check this out, 15 verses 1 and 2. Now the tax collectors and the sinners were all drawing near to hear him, Jesus. Verse 2, and the Pharisees and the scribes, they grumbled. And they said, this man receives sinners. He doesn't talk down to them. He doesn't put them in their place. He doesn't reject them. And he eats with them, which in Jewish culture was a very intimate thing. There are two groups in these verses, as you note. The tax collectors and sinners are one group, and then they are the Pharisees. These are two about as diverse groups as you can get. They did not belong together like oil and water or conservatives and liberals, red state, blue state, Duke or UNC fans. Just these two should never meet, okay? The Pharisees and the scribes. Now, they were a group that had made moral and religious perfection part of their lives. They were responsible. They were upstanding. They had it together. They were devoted in their religion, and they tried their darndest to keep every single thing that God had told them to do. Then you got this other group, the tax collectors and sinners. Now, you might just overlook exactly who these people are. You know, people see the word tax collector, and many times they think, and I've even heard it described this way, like IRS agents. And you're like, yeah, those people are totally annoying. That's what the tax collectors were like. Well, that's not really what a tax collector was in that day. You see, we've got this kind of lazy, almost romantic view of what Rome was from watching movies like The Gladiator, right? You know, the Romans were not like the depiction you see in the movie Gladiator. They were a harsh, brutally savage nation who ruled the world with an iron fist. I've explained to you, in fact, I did this just a few weeks ago, that whenever Rome would take over a city, often what they would do is what they did to some of these Jewish cities, they would take the men, women, and children of that city, sometimes up to 20 or 30,000 of them, and they would crucify them along the roads leading into that city. So for 40 or 50 miles, as you came into that city, you would be passing by the dead and dying corpses of men, women, and children with a message given, don't mess with Rome. All right, that's what they were. That's how they ruled the people that they conquered. Military rule was extraordinarily expensive. If you're going to try to control every city in the world this way, you got to have a lot of soldiers. Right? And so what they would do in order to pay these soldiers is they would take one of the citizens of the city that they had conquered, and they would get this person to act as their tax collector. right? And what this guy would do is forcibly, using other soldiers, extort money from the citizens. And every single bit of it would go to Rome, except for a pretty sizable amount that he would keep for himself that Rome let him have as a way of, you know, recouping for the trouble he was in. This guy was a betrayer of his people. He had sold himself out completely so that he could get rich off of his own people by extorting them, many of his own family members and friends, by extorting money from them to pay the soldiers who would brutalize and kill them and murder their children. So when you say they're like IRS agents, that doesn't quite cut it, right? I mean, you catch what I'm saying? There's no cultural equivalent we have in America for a tax collector. The point is, these guys are varsity level sinners. Okay, these are not average, ordinary JV sinners. These guys are big league. And most of them lived with an extraordinary amount of guilt, and many of them with regret. I mean, they had betrayed their own families. And here they are, together with the prostitutes and the lewd women and the thugs, right? And their thought is, surely God hates us and looks down on us because everybody else does. The other group, the Pharisees, well, they agree with that assessment. And they're like, yes, God has given up on you because you are simply a bad person. But I want you to look in chapter 15 at what's happening. These sinners are now crowding around Jesus. You see, Jesus had this way about him. Everywhere he went, people who normally weren't into religion were, for whatever reason, into him. There was just something about him, something that they picked up on that they found irresistible, something they wanted to be around. People who weren't into religion and whom religion had rejected, for whatever reason, were into Jesus. So in response to this brewing little conflict, Jesus tells a succession of three stories, which act somewhat like a progression, each one building on the last. Let me walk you through these very quickly. In verses 3 through 7, chapter 15, Jesus tells the story of a man who has 100 sheep and loses one of them. And when he discovers that the one is missing, it says that he counts them and discovers this one is gone, and he leaves the 99 to go after this one, has to go searching everywhere for him. And when he finds him, his heart is filled with gladness because his one sheep that he had lost was now recovered. Verses 8 through 10, the metaphor changes. Now Jesus tells a story about a woman, a single woman, a widow who has 10 coins. All right? The irony, by the way, in this is that the men care for the little animals and the women care about the money. Right? Do you catch that? I'm sure he didn't mean that. It wasn't intentional. All right? But this story actually takes it up a notch, because now you're not dealing with 100 and losing one. You're dealing with 10 and losing one. Right? And by the way, these are not pennies either. The word for coin in the Greek language is the word drachma, which is about the equivalent of a day's wage. This is an extraordinarily large amount of money for a single lady to possess. And so when she loses one, she searches everywhere. And Jesus said she gets out the broom and she gets her friends together and they turn over every piece of furniture and they look for this coin that she has lost. And then Jesus, one more time, changes the metaphor and he tells the story that is probably one of the most famous stories in all of his parables. And that is the story of the prodigal son. About the father who sees one of his sons take his inheritance and go off into a far country and just completely expend his inheritance. Again, the stakes are raised. With the sheep, you had 100 and lost one. That was 1%. With the coin, you had 10 and lost one. That's 10%. Now you've got two sons and lose one. That's 50%. But in this story, a little drama is added. Because it's not an object like a sheep, which doesn't, you know, is not a person, and it's not a coin, which is an inanimate object. This son has a sense of what he's doing, and he shames his father. In taking the money, his inheritance from the father, he is saying to his father, I mean, what do you say when you want your inheritance early? Right? When do you get somebody's inheritance? Right? When they die, right? So he is saying to his father, I wish you were dead. I don't want to be around you. All I want is your money. I want you to give it to me so I can go and live apart from you. Right? So that amount of drama is added. But still, in Jesus' story, the father loves this wandering son and longs for him to come home. So that when this son finally comes to his senses and returns, it says the father, seeing him a long way off, begins to run after his son and embraces him and brings him back into the family. Then, at the end of these three stories, Jesus adds an unexpected and turned twist, which completely explains what he's trying to do here. And that is, he introduces this older son. This older son who says to his father, what are you doing? You're welcoming this guy who has shamed the family, the guy who's made stupid decisions, who's blown half of the money that you possess, and you're bringing him back in. And this older son, in kind of a rage and a huff, walks out of the house and says, I don't want to be a part of this. And the story ends with the father going now out to this other son, right? And by the way, you know who this older son represents? It represents that other group that Jesus is talking to, the Pharisees. Right? The first son is this group of tax collectors and sinners. Now the older son represents this group of Pharisees, and the father goes out to him and says, verse 32, what are you doing? It is fitting to celebrate and be glad, because this is your brother. And he was dead, but now he's alive. He was lost, and now he's found. The point that Jesus is making in all three of these stories is that these sinners, these tax collectors, these people that others are calling despicable, the ones that you think are lost and gone and far from God, Jesus is saying, they matter to me. They matter to me. You see, there's three elements in these stories that kind of arise. All right, that's the first one. That is that lost people are of great value to God. I want you to look at how he asks the question in verse 4. It's worded very, very interestingly. Verse 4, he says, what man of you, having 100 sheep, if he's lost one of them, what man of you would not leave the 99 and go into the open country and go after that one is lost until he's found it? In other words, he's like, which one of you wouldn't do this? Of course you would. Lost people are like that to me. Verse 8, in telling the story of the woman who lost the coin, he asked the same question. Which woman wouldn't search and scour her house to find this lost coin that she's got? Of course you would do that. And then he says, people are like that to me. I hope you see this as an incredible picture of our Heavenly Father searching for you in the most tender of ways, looking all over for you, retracing the steps back to where he believes that he has lost you. You know, recently this became very real to my wife and I in a very unusual way. Veronica, my wife, was having some work done on her wedding ring. The guy who did the work gave it back to her. She put it in her pocket, and when she got home, could not find it. We went to every single place that we had been that evening. I had to just about bring her at a restaurant to get him let me take. I had to wait until the couple that was currently in the booth was gone so that I could then take apart that booth and look and see if perhaps it had fallen out of her pocket, right? You know, and we went back and we traced all the steps. We expended just 2 or 3 days of focused energy trying to discover where that ring was. The most unbelievable truth is that's how God is, going back to the place that you were lost. Let me ask you a question. Where was that for you? Maybe you were abused as a child or as a teenager, and at that point you decided you couldn't trust people or God. This week I learned something that I did not know, and that is porn stars and prostitutes today. Do you know what percentage of porn stars or prostitutes were sexually abused in their adolescent years? 90%. You think of a little girl so full of trust to her daddy, whose daddy abuses her. And she learns, I can't trust people with power. And so as she grows old, she begins to make decisions, acting out that lack of trust. And what it looks like today is a life of prostitution or a life of completely immoral behavior, but it goes back to those actions. You know, I read a statistic recently that's kind of blew my mind, and that's 30% of the women in Raleigh-Durham. And that would mean 30% of the women in this room were sexually abused at some point in their past. And I wonder how that affects you. Wonder how it affects your relationship to God. You know, I remember reading on another angle that there was, if you take all the famous atheists of the past century, specifically Albert Camus, Aldous Huxley, Friedrich Nietzsche, Bertrand Russell, Paul Sartre, Madeleine Murray O'Hare, all of them had one thing in common. You know what that was? All of them had a father who either abused or abandoned or died on them in childhood. Many of you might trace that place that you departed from God back to that first drink where alcohol became the means by which you dealt with your problems. Or maybe it's that first look at pornography. Maybe it was that first flirtatious glance with your secretary or with someone that you worked with. Maybe it was the first time you took a hit on that drug, or maybe it was the first time that you cheated on a test. Whatever it is, these stories tell you that God has gone back to that spot just like I went back for that ring. We never found it, by the way, that ring. But God went back to that place and he searched for you. You see, there's something that really significant that happened after Jesus' resurrection, which people a lot of times overlook in the excitement of him resurrecting. You overlook some of the details that the Bible puts in this story for you, right? The first place that Jesus meets man after the resurrection was where? It was in the garden. That's right, a garden right outside of the tomb. The place that God and man had separated at the beginning of time was where? It was in a garden. That's right. God had gone looking for man in the place that he was lost. You see, in the first story, at the beginning of time, God had gone looking for man, and man was hiding because of his betrayal of God. Now, after the resurrection, man is looking for God in the garden, and God comes back and rescues and finds him. God goes back to the places that you and he departed, back at the very place you left him. And he would say to you, others hurt you, I will not. Others lied to you, I will not. You may think that your life is a waste. You may think that because of whatever decisions you've made or whatever things happen to you, your life is worth nothing but to be discarded or thrown away, right? You may think that you have no future, that you will forever be chained to your past. But Jesus sees you differently. He doesn't see what you are or what you have been. He sees you through the eyes of what you could be and what he intends to make you. That is the first theme that emerges from these stories. That leads to the second theme, and that is that God seeks us at great personal cost to himself. You see, in the story of the prodigal son, there is a hint of what Jesus is talking about, because the father, when he sees his son coming back, runs to him. Commentators point out how odd this is, because Jewish fathers did not run. Children ran. Women ran. In order to run, you have to pick up your robe and bare your legs, which fathers did not do. They were stately. They carried themselves with dignity. What you see is this father laying aside his dignity to go and find his son. Then he takes his best robe, it says, presumably off of his own back, and lays it on the son's tattered clothing, his filthy garments, and said, here is your new robe. In these details, in this story, there is a hint of the cross, where God would lay aside his dignity and take upon himself the shame and condemnation for our sin and clothe us with his righteousness and his privilege, so that we again could be called the innocent, perfect, completed sons and daughters of God. There are two phrases about sacrifice I am hoping that you will learn, and they start first with Jesus, and we learn them from him. Here is the first one. The value that we place on something is shown by what we will give up for it. Now, I told you that last week. The value you place on something is shown by what you'll give up for it. What does that say, then, about the value that Jesus placed on you? Here's the second phrase I want you to learn. Sacrifice is giving up something you love for something that you love even more. What Jesus loved more than he loved his life and his place with the Father was you. The God who had everything gave it all up for you. The God who controlled the universe turned his back on it so that he could rescue you. You see, the word we use to describe that is precious. You were precious to him. I've often used the analogy of a medicine. If you were diagnosed with a disease that would take your life, and the doctor came to you and said, there is a cure for this disease, but it has not been approved yet, which means insurance will not pay for it. Without this medicine, you will die. With this medicine, you will live. But you're going to have to pay for it. And in order to pay for it, it's so expensive. You've got to sell your house. You're going to have to sell your car. You're going to have to get rid of all your belongings just to be able to afford this. Almost all of us would gladly turn our back on all our possessions to uphold a medicine that could save our or one of our family members' lives. Right? That medicine is precious to you. The God who possessed the universe turned it back so that he could come and embrace you. And he ran and shed his dignity so that he could find you. And that leads me to number three, and that is that our rescue creates compassion in us for others. You see, all these stories culminate in that last little scene of the prodigal son story, where the older brother is ticked off and goes outside to pout. And you'll notice that the father in these verses goes outside to him. Commentators point out that this son has also left the presence of the father, just like the younger son had left. The other son took off and went into the far country. This guy just walks outside the house, but both of them are rejecting the father. And so the father has to go outside to the older son. And he says to him, "Son, why aren't you rejoicing?" You see, in these other two stories, the two that led up to this one, it talks about those in the house rejoicing when that lost thing was found. You go back to the story of the shepherd who lost the sheep. There's this verse, "There will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance." And then in the next story, the lost coin, she goes to her neighbors and they rejoice with her. And Jesus said, verse 10, "Just so I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents." You see, the angels in God's presence, they know what makes God happy. They love God, so they rejoice when God rejoices. You know what that tells you? That tells you that when I finally, when I was 16 years old, turned over control of my life, when I came to my senses and realized that a life of rebellion, a life of me deciding what I wanted to do, a life where I set the agenda, when I realized how insane that was, when I got down on my knees at 16 years old and I turned over control of my life to Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ saved me, that means that there was a smile that broke across the Father's face, and the angels saw that, and sensing that, they broke into a party. Right? And then Jesus turns to this older son who represents the Pharisee, and he says, "If you're not moved to compassion for lost people, it must be because for all of your religious duty, you don't really know God and you don't really love God. Because if so, you would be moved by the things that move him. Furthermore, you must not have a sense of what I've given to you." That's what the father says to the son in verse 31. He says, "Son, all that I have is yours." Right? Don't you realize how gracious I've been to you? You didn't earn any of this. I'm giving it all to you. You see, here's the second part of that. If you're not moved to compassion for lost people, it must be because you don't realize how gracious God has been with you. Religious people don't have compassion for lost people. They look down on them. They criticize them. They have political platforms that condemn and isolate those kinds of people, right? Because they don't know God. Their religious accomplishment and all their duty leads to pride and hate. And they look down on others and they say, "You got what you deserved, and I'm better than you, and that's why God rewards me." And they're religious, but they don't know God or love God. You see, on the other hand, the sign that you do know God is that you have a sense, a profound sense of being found, and that creates a real, almost involuntary sense of compassion for others. You are moved by the needs of others, even when they are in situations of their own making. And so just like Jesus, you want to give up something you love for something you love even more, and that is someone who is lost. By the way, these three parables end in a question. The story never resolves, and if you notice that, you don't know what the older son is going to do. It ends, Jesus' story ends with the older son outside. The religious person, it ends with the question, are you going to come back to God? You see, Jesus was asking the question to the Pharisees. He's asking a question to us, and that question is, are you going to care for lost people like I care about them? You see, here's why I share this and what I think it means for our church. The focus of our church must be on lost people. Why? Because they matter to God. And we love God, so they matter to us. And furthermore, God rescued each of us at great personal cost to himself So now we will attempt to rescue others, even at great personal cost to ourselves. So what that means? That means that we will not get distracted from our mission into any secondary purposes by the grace of God. Because people, individual people, people who aren't necessarily like us and may not even feel comfortable here, they are the ones that are our mission. It's not buildings. You know, I've explained to you that we are not going to get sidelined from reaching people by building some gargantuan monument to a God who dwells in temples not made with hands. Right? I mean, we're going to have functionality. That's our word in this, is we've got to do what it takes to be able to reach people, not to just create useless beauty, in our opinion, but to go after people. And so functionality, not buildings, not politics. I've explained that numerous times. I've got my political opinions, okay? Probably got more than anybody in here. But it's like I've said before, I will not build a church around those political opinions. Why? Because I know that I might be wrong about global warming, but I am not wrong about the gospel. And so I will not let my opinions on the former keep people from hearing me about the latter. Sometimes people say to me, I wish you'd talk more about homosexuality and abortion. I wish you preached on that more often. Listen, I know, I understand. And I want to be clear that those things are against the law of God and that they are sin. But my mission is not to establish a political agenda here, but to offer redemption and freedom to people enslaved by sexual sin of all types, and to offer forgiveness to those who have made the tragic mistake of abortion. I've got a pastor friend who talks about before he got into pastoring, before he was in ministry, he had become friends with a girl who was a lesbian. And so he invited this girl to church. She would never go. Right? And so finally he tricked her to going to church because a friend of theirs was going to be playing in a concert. That's what he said, I want you to come and hear our friend play. He just didn't tell her it was going to be at the church. So she comes in, figures out they're in a church service. They listen to the people play, and then the speaker gets up. And this guy says that, this guy announced that the topic for the evening was sexual purity. And he said this guy proceeded to preach the most fear-mongering sermon on sexual purity he had ever heard, where the guy talks about, you know, man, if you don't stay sexually pure, you're going to get herpes, and you're going to get all kinds of venereal diseases, and just talked about this for 30 or 40 minutes. At the beginning of the talk, this guy took out a rose. Rose, had everybody look at it, and then this audience of several hundred people, he just hands it to one of the people and says, take a look at this rose. Just pass it around and take a look at it. So for the whole duration of his talk, 35 or 40 minutes, they take this rose and they pass it around. Then after all this talk, at the end of this talk, he takes that rose back up and he holds it up. Of course, now after being handled by 400 or 500 people, it's all falling apart, it's wilted, it's just destroyed. And he holds that rose up and he says, who actually wants this thing anymore? And after it's been handled by so many people, after you've given yourself sexually and you've just been destroyed, who actually would want you anymore? And that's how he ends the sermon. And my friend said he was shaking with rage as he sat there beside his lesbian friend, listening to this, and in his heart, he was just saying, Jesus wants that rose. Because Jesus did not come, John 3:17, to condemn. And that doesn't mean he doesn't tell us what sin is. Jesus was clear on the law of God, and he said that those who sin cannot enter into the kingdom of God. He was crystal clear on that. But Jesus said, my purpose, the Son of Man has not come to bring condemnation, but that you might have life. That's how God loved the world, as he came for the people that were falling apart and had nothing and said, I want you. You see, yes, I want to preach against sin, but what I want to preach is that Jesus is for people. And the reason he's against sin is because he's for people. We're not going to get distracted in this church by God's grace into minor theological squabbles. Some churches get all hot and bothered by when the rapture is going to happen. Is it before the trib, after the trib, during the trib? We're going to get new robes in heaven, you know? Will we be able to watch people from heaven? And can we look down? There's all these arguments, and they argue and argue and argue and put their charts up all over the wall. And I'm like, the point is, he's coming back. That's the point, okay? I got my opinions, and I think they're right, and I'll tell you about them sometime. But for the time being, all right? Let's get ready, because I know that really the deal is he's coming back. He's coming back for people. Calvinism. I hear this from time to time. Pastor JD, do you think God elects those who will be saved? And they ask me that as if that will determine whether or not they come to our church. And I'm like, look, I got my views on that. But the bottom line is this. The more I share Christ with people, the more people seem to getting elected. All right? I don't know how it works. And you can sit around if you want and fathom the depths of God's mind, or you can join us in obeying God and taking the gospel to every person on earth. Right? It means that all of our programs, everything we do, we will run through the grid of reaching people. Every part of our church, we set up for people. We ask this question about all of our programs. Does this help us reach people? Right? For example, when you got here, you were greeted by a huge team of people, whatever campus you showed up at. You know why? We know that our ministry starts in the parking lot. Because we've learned this. I read a statistic the other day. It was a Barna study of what people, they experience at church. And it revealed 70% of new people decide whether or not they will come back to a church in the first 7 minutes of arriving on a campus. Right? You know what that means for us? It means that we say this a lot to our volunteers. The sermon starts in the parking lot. Before they ever get in here and hear a word I've saying, they have already made up their mind whether or not they're coming back. And so that's why we got people standing out there with those dorky orange vests, and we got people with umbrellas so when it rains they can help escort people in, and we got people standing every 3 or 4 feet, it seems, out there to tell people, hey, this is where you need to go. Right? I mean, we got a comment back on one of our comment cards that I don't know if it was a compliment or not, but I took it as one. They said, coming to your church was like going to an Amway convention. Just every 3 or 4 feet, people smiling with this little thing gleam in their eye, and they're like, come on in, you know, and I don't know, but the point is this. Listen, we want everything at this church, from how we treat the children to how we clean our toilets to scream, you are important and you matter to God. All right? The third little thing here is that we each need to live in pursuit of lost people. Each of us needs to live in pursuit of lost people. My wife and I, we're watching the news the other night, and they had this little thing come back on there about the mother of Natalie Holloway still down in Aruba looking for her daughter. I think it's going on something like 4 years now. And I know many of you have seen it, and I know that some of you look at that, and it's not that you have no compassion. You're just like, enough already. You got to let it go. But you know, there's a part of every parent that understands at least a little what she's doing. Because I know that if one of my daughters were missing, that I would search and I would search and I would search. And as long as there were any chance she was still alive, I would never stop looking. That's how God is with people. And that's how we as his followers are going to be too. Paul said it this way to the Corinthians in the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 5. He said, do we appear like we're out of our minds? It's for you. Are we out of our minds? It's for you. You think this is all crazy? You think we've lost our minds? There's a reason. And it's because we know that you matter to God. And we would give up anything we had to be able to reach you. I remember how moved I was in seminary reading the story about the two young Moravian missionaries who, in the first settlement of our country, after they lived here in one of the cities, one of the first cities here in the United States, discovered that there was an island down in the Caribbean that had an atheist for an owner. And this atheist was a slave master. And he had populated that entire Caribbean island with a bunch of slaves from Africa. And he refused to let anybody come onto that island to share the gospel with them because he was an atheist. And these guys tried, and they begged, and they pleaded, and they offered money to this guy to let him come down there to work with these slaves. And the guy just every time said no. And these two German-originated Moravian missionaries did the only thing that they could do to get to these slaves, and that is they sold themselves into slavery as 23-year-old men for the rest of their lives, to go live on an island with slaves as slaves so that they could reach those slaves with the gospel. And as the story gets told, as they were put in their shackles after they had given themselves into slavery, and as they were bound and they were put on that ship like cattle, and as their family, people from all over the East Coast, came to watch what was happening, and as they stood on the deck, or they stood on the shore, and they watched that ship pull away, one of the people records that the last words that were heard by one of these guys, ever, never heard from or seen again, is one of these newly incarcerated slaves lifts up his hands in shackles and he points straight up and he says, "May the lamb that was slain receive the reward of his suffering." Never gone. Are we out of our minds? It's for you. For some of you, I know it's not nearly that dramatic. For some of you, it's simply walking across the cul-de-sac, right? And just sharing Christ. Right? You've never had your neighbors over for dinner. You've never invited your coworker to come be a part of this. My wife and I were talking about this last night. You know, she was like, you know, the reason that our church grows, the reason God has blessed the Summit Church, at least partially, is because if you know us, we plan, we pray, we work hard, and then we are creative in how we engage people. And my wife told me, she said, "I think the reason we have not reached more of our neighbors is because we do things differently in the church than we do in our personal lives." Right, at the church, we're praying and planning and reaching out and being creative, and we work hard. Right, and then for our neighbors, we don't put nearly that kind of energy into it. That's what it means. It means we will be out of our minds for people. Well, this is also what is behind what our church is doing now, this Believe Project. You see, we know that Jesus still cares for people like he cared in these stories. So we believe in him and we look to him and we yield our resources to him to let him do something amazing here in the Triangle. You see, I am not trying to lead you. We are not trying to build something for God. I'm simply trying to release God to do what he wants to do here because I believe that the picture he gave us in Luke 15 is still the picture that he is and of what he feels for people that are lost. In 1750, there was a guy named William Carey who believed that Jesus cared for lost people in the third world. And so he began to say to all of his fellow Christians here in America, "God cares for these people, in Britain, as much as he cares for us." And one of the leaders of the church, in a very famous scene, as he is pleading with them to give some of their people and some of their money to go to these people in India, one of the church leaders said, "Young man, sit down. You are out of your mind." And William Carey, this is not an exact quote, but basically his response is, "Maybe I am out of my mind, but if it's so, it's for the people of India." William Carey became the father of the modern missionary movement. And there was a statement that he used to make that I read in his biography, and I've never forgotten it. He made that statement, "You expect great things from God, and then you attempt great things for God." That's another way of saying believe. And that is what we are doing. We are believing on behalf of the prostitute in our city who has not yet found redemption. We are believing on behalf of the family that is suffering from divorce or is on the heel of divorce who needs healing. We are believing on behalf of the drug addict who has not yet found freedom. We are believing on behalf of the skeptic who still needs to find assurance of faith, or for the seeker who is confused and lost and whom Jesus is looking for. We are believing on behalf of my children who need to grow up in a Christian community and find Jesus, because all of these people matter to Jesus. That is what our church is about. What we've done is we put together a little collage, okay, for you of people at our church here whom God has changed. And I want you just to look at it. I want you to watch it. And I want you to realize that what was talked about in Luke 15, that audience, is still right outside of our doors.